content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the October 2023 edition of Education Today. We'll get started with an article from U.S. News titled, These 10 States Have the Most Racially Equal High School Dropout Rates, by Julia Haynes, posted September 14. Attritional Equality. The high school dropout rate in the U.S. has slowly declined over the last decade, standing at 5.2% in 2021, compared with 8.3% in 2010. Yet dropout rates can vary significantly among different racial and ethnic groups. While the national high school dropout rate for Asian students was only about 2% for the period 2017 to 2021, for example, the rates for American Indian and Alaska Native students, 9.7%, and Hispanic students, 7.7%, were much higher. Breaking down the data further shows how gaps between racial and ethnic groups persist and vary at the state level. As part of the Racial Equality in America Project, U.S. News compared high school dropout rates of racial and ethnic groups in a state to the rate of the state's overall population, measuring the average disparity between the two categories. States were ranked based on the size of their disparity, with higher values resulting in a worse ranking for racial equality and high school dropout rates. Disparities in high school dropout rates are reflected as a percentage point difference. As an example, while Wisconsin and Utah are tied for having the 13th lowest high school dropout rate nationwide, both at about 4.37% from 2017 to 2021, large gaps between groups in Wisconsin point to a higher level of disparity. Dropout rates in the Badger State range from 2% among Asian students to approximately 11% among Black students, marking the second highest rate for Black students nationwide among states with sufficient data. In Utah, meanwhile, dropout rates range from 3% for Asian students to 8% for Hispanic students. While there can be different ways to measure high school dropout rates, these figures reflect the percentage of 16 to 24-year-olds who are not enrolled in school and who do not hold a high school diploma or equivalent degree. These are the 10 states where high school dropout rates are the most equal across racial and ethnic groups, as assessed by U.S. News. Learn more about the Racial Equality in America Project in our methodology. So the top 10 states are number 10, New Jersey, 9, Utah, 8, New York, 7, Florida, 6, North Carolina, 5, Arkansas, 4, California, 3, Indiana, 2, Hawaii, and 1, Missouri. The next article comes from Education Week, and it's titled, No, AI Won't Destroy Education, but We Should Be Skeptical. Artificial Intelligence is a Reminder of the Importance of Teaching Students How to Learn, by Lorraine Langriot, posted August 31st, 2023. Type artificial intelligence news on any search engine, and you would likely see the same doomsday headlines I've seen in the last few months. How could AI destroy humanity? Goldman Sachs predicts 300 million jobs will be lost or degraded by artificial intelligence. And the AI-powered totally autonomous future of war is here. Even the AI-powered autocomplete search engine features finished the sentence, will artificial intelligence, with similar apocalypses. Will artificial intelligence replace humans? Take away jobs? Take over the world? Artificial intelligence and its use are not new. Computer scientists have been working on improving the technology for decades, and a lot of the tools we use daily, navigation apps, facial recognition, social media, voice assistants, search engines, smartwatches, run on AI. And beyond that, most, if not all, industries are already using AI one way or another. It's in healthcare, transportation, the military, finance, telecommunications, drug research, education, and more. But since the arrival of ChatGPT almost a year ago, AI has captivated the public's attention and reignited discussions about how it could transform the world. In the K-12 space, Educators have been discussing what and how much of a role AI should play in instruction, especially as AI experts say today's students need to learn how to use it effectively in order to be successful in future jobs. Right now, educators are unsure of AI's superpowers. When the EdWeek Research Center asked a nationally representative group of 1,301 educators over the summer what they thought the impact of AI would be on teaching and learning in their school or district over the next 5 years, 49% said AI will have an equally negative and positive impact, 28% said mostly negative, 13% said mostly positive, and 10% said no impact. Even with the healthy dose of skepticism, several educators have told me that schools need to accept that ChatGPT and other AI tools like it are here to stay. Schools, they argue, need to find ways to use the technology for the benefit of teaching and learning while being aware of its potential downsides. AI is calling for a fundamental reevaluation of what the goal of education is, said Chat Towernicki, an 8th grade English teacher in the 4800 student Wissahickon School District in Pennsylvania. What's different with the arrival of ChatGPT? AI technologies replicate human thinking by training computer systems to do tasks that simulate some of what the human brain can do. They rely on systems that can actually learn, usually by analyzing vast quantities of data and searching out new patterns and relationships. These systems can improve over time, becoming more complex and accurate as they take in more information. Or they can become more inaccurate if they're pulling from faulty data. ChatGPT is an AI-powered tool from research laboratory OpenAI that can hold human-like conversations and instantly answer seemingly any prompt. But instead of learning a computer programming language to talk to the chatbot, people can just communicate with it in their natural language. People began to realize something is different, said Glenn Kleiman, a senior advisor at the Stanford Graduate School of Education, whose research focuses on the potential of AI to enhance teaching and learning. Suddenly, the capabilities became available to everybody and easily accessible. Now, people are using AI to plan trips, draft emails, organize essays, summarize research papers, and write code. In K-12 classrooms, teachers have used ChatGPT to plan lessons, put together rubrics, provide students feedback on assignments, respond to parent emails, and write letters of recommendation. It's easy to get wrapped up in the hype surrounding the transformative powers of this next generation of AI. Many technology CEOs have been quick to talk up its groundbreaking potential. With its new capabilities, AI can become our co-author, co-pilot, or personal assistant. Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, believes the technology will help people become way more efficient and productive at their jobs. He sees it as an engine for new job creation. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from the New York Times, and it's titled, DEI Statements Stir Debate on College Campuses. Yoel Inbar, a psychology professor, thought he might be teaching at UCLA, but his reservations about diversity statements got him in trouble. By Michael Powell, published September 8, 2023. Yoel Inbar, a noted psychology professor at the University of Toronto, figured he might be teaching this fall at UCLA. Last year, the university's psychology department offered his female partner a faculty appointment. Now the department was interested in recruiting him as a so-called partner hire, a common practice in academia. The university asked him to fill out the requisite papers, including a statement that affirmed his belief and work in diversity, equity, and inclusion. He flew out and met with, among others, a faculty diversity committee and a group of graduate students. Dr. Inbar figured all had gone well, that his work in liberal politics fit well with the university. Some faculty members, he said, had even advised him on house hunting. But a few days later, the department chair emailed and told him that more than 50 graduate students had signed a letter strongly denouncing his candidacy. Why? In part because on his podcast years earlier, he had opposed diversity statements, like the one he had just written. Not long after, the chair told Dr. Inbar that, with regret, UCLA could not offer him a job. Diversity statements are a new flashpoint on campus, just as the Supreme Court has driven a stake through race-conscious admissions. Nearly half the large universities in America require that job applicants write such statements, part of the rapid growth in DEI programs. Many University of California departments now require that faculty members seeking promotions and tenure also write such statements. Diversity statements tend to run about a page or so long and ask candidates to describe how they would contribute to campus diversity, often seeking examples of how the faculty member has fostered an inclusive or anti-racist learning environment. To supporters, such statements are both skill assessment and business strategy. Given the ban on race-conscious admissions and the need to attract applicants from a shrinking pool of potential students, many colleges are looking to create a more welcoming environment. But critics say these statements are thinly veiled attempts at enforcing ideological orthodoxy. Politically savvy applicants, they say, learn to touch on the right ideological buzzwords, and the championing of diversity can overshadow strengths seen as central to academia, not least professional expertise. Professions of fealty to DEI ideology are so ubiquitous as to be meaningless, said Daniel Sargent, a professor of history and public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. We are institutionalizing a performative dishonesty. Erwin Chemerinsky, the dean of Berkeley's law school and a free speech scholar, describes much of the criticism as an attack on diversity, even as he acknowledges that the requirement could be misused. The point of the statements, he said, is to push applicants to think through how they can reach students. I'll tell you, the professors who don't recognize the diversity in their classrooms are going to struggle, he said. Some of the best teachers are quite politically conservative, but they're still aware of who's in the classroom. The debate occurs as DEI officials and programs of all kinds have become a powerful presence on campuses. Universities have hired hundreds of administrators who monitor compliance with hiring goals and curricular changes, and many departments write a variation on a DEI policy. The Faculty Senate at the University of California, San Francisco, urged professors to apply anti-oppression and anti-racism lenses to courses. The Public Affairs School at the University of California, Los Angeles, pledged on its website to decolonize the curriculum and pedagogy, and the medical school vowed to dismantle systematic racism in its coursework. The Faculty Senate of the California Community Colleges, the largest higher education system in the country, has instructed its teachers on their obligation to, quote, lift the veil of white supremacy and colonialism. Conservative Republican politicians demonstrated their disdain and brought the power of the state to bear. Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida and Governor Greg Abbott of Texas signed bills shuttering campus DEI offices. Florida barred curriculums that teach identity politics and theories of systematic racism, sexism, and privilege. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from NBC News, and it's titled, Alabama Public Library Service Votes to Create a List of Inappropriate Books for Kids, posted September 15, 2023, by Matt Lavieres. The Alabama Public Library Service will issue a list of books that it considers inappropriate for children. Its seven-member board voted unanimously Wednesday in favor of the proposal to create such a list with the goal of protecting kids. Parents still have access to it if they want to buy this for their children, John Wall, a board member and the chairman of the Alabama Republican Party, told WSFA-TV, a local NBC affiliate in Montgomery, but we don't want to have it in libraries where innocent children can stumble upon it. While the list has not yet been created, the move comes amid a nationwide debate over whether children should have access to books and coursework that contain topics on LGBTQ identities or race. Ryan Godfrey, a spokesperson for the Alabama Public Library Service, said in a phone call that the board decided to create the list after an uptick in complaints about sexually explicit content in library books over the last several months. He noted that some of the titles being challenged have LGBTQ themes. The list will be curated following submissions from the public and will be available on the Library Service's website. The Library Service will review all submissions and decide which of the challenged books will be added to the list, he said. A timeline for when the list will be published has not yet been released. Opponents of the upcoming list predicted that many of the books on the list will contain LGBTQ content. Lauren Boone, a member of Read Freely Alabama, a nonprofit group for free speech, told WSFA that while the list is being marketed as something that will protect children, underneath it's anti-LGBTQ+. Hannah Rees, with Cleanup Alabama, one of the groups that advocated for the list, pushed back on Boone's argument. This has nothing to do with the LGBTQ community specifically, she told WSFA. This has to do with sexually explicit content and radical ideologies that are being promoted to our young children. Godfrey noted that the Alabama Public Library Service does not have the authority to ban or request certain books to be removed from state library shelves. It's really supposed to be an informational list and guide for public librarians to use in deciding what books to purchase for the libraries and what books for maybe them to consider moving or shelving in another location, he said. It's not intended to censor or remove books in any kind of way. Alabama is not alone in putting increased attention on what books may or may not be appropriate for minors. Last year, for example, the American Library Association recorded the highest number of attempted book bans nationwide since it began tracking such book challenges in 2001. More than half of the 13 books on the group's most challenged books list last year, including three of the top four, were challenged for having LGBTQ themes. Last month, Florida's Education Department released a list of about 300 books that school districts across the state removed from library shelves last school year. Dozens of the removed books contain LGBTQ themes or characters or topics on race. The next article comes from K-12 Dive, and it's titled, Bill Would Ensure Parents Know of Right to Invite Experts to Special Ed Meetings. IDEA already requires schools to inform parents of this right, but supporters of a House proposal say some parents are unaware. Published September 15, 2023, by Kara Arundel. Schools would be required to notify parents of students with disabilities that they can invite people with additional knowledge or expertise to participate in individualized education program meetings under the proposed Think Differently About Education Act. These IEP members invited by parents can include people who know the child or who have special expertise about that child's special education services. The bill H.R. 4259 was introduced by Representative Marcus Molinaro, Republican from New York, and approved 39-0 Thursday during a House Committee on Education and Workforce markup session. In voicing support for the bill, which will now move to the House floor for consideration, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle acknowledged that the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act already allows parents to invite others to be part of the IEP team meetings. This bill, supporters said, but help make sure schools notify parents of this right. This proposal appears to restate present law and ensures that parents are aware of and can exercise a right they already have under current law. So I am not opposed to it, said Ranking Member Bobby Scott, Democrat from Virginia. However, I want to make clear that I am not advocating to further amendments to the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act at this time. Also included in the legislation is a substitute offered by Representative Aaron Bean, Republican from Florida, that he said would change the parental notification requirement from occurring at the beginning of each school year to occurring each school year prior to the first convening of the IEP team meeting. Bean explained that he made the proposal because most annual IEP team meetings take place in the spring in preparation for the IEP to be up to date for the start of the next school year. Students' IEPs must be updated annually. When parents are informed of their rights, they are more likely to become active participants in the child's education and look out, because when parents are involved in their kids' education, exceptional students will thrive, Bean said. IDEA already includes school-to-parent prior written notice and procedural safeguards notice requirements for when schools are adding, changing, or denying special education services to students. The next article comes from the Washington Post, and it's titled, WVU Board Approves Cuts in Academic Programs. At a contentious meeting, a few faculty positions were spared, but most of the cuts went through. By Susan Sirluga and Nick Anderson, posted September 15, 2023. West Virginia University's Board of Governors voted Friday to approve cuts to academic programs during a chaotic meeting disrupted by protesters chanting, waving signs, and shouting. In a number of votes, the board agreed to eliminate 28 academic majors and 143 faculty positions. A few faculty positions were spared from the administration's proposal by board action, but the Board of Governors pushed a majority of the changes through. The proposals had brought national attention to the university amid debates over the future of higher education, the value of liberal arts, and the need to prepare students for rapidly changing job markets. the WVU administration had argued that the changes were necessary to combat a financial shortfall and allow investments in areas of higher demand, and would affect a relatively small number of students. But faculty, students, alumni, and others fought fiercely against the cuts, with campaigns to stop donations to the state flagship, faculty votes in opposition, emotional pleas in public hearings, and angry protests. Students packed the meeting Friday wearing red, chanting, "Stop the cuts," and holding signs with slogans such as, "Burn couches, not courses." After the votes, a woman took her sign proclaiming, "This isn't the WVU I fell in love with," and held it directly in front of each board member who had voted for the changes. Layoffs may be common in the business world, but it's not part of the culture of academia. And the elimination of faculty jobs is seen as a threat to tenure, said Frances E. Frankie Tack, speaking from her role as the Faculty Senate Chair, although she is also a faculty representative on the board. With diminishing state funding, she said, the university is facing tough choices. "I do think it's necessary," she said of the cuts. "I voted against today because I represent the voice of the faculty. And the bottom line is, it's awful. Even if it does need to be done, it's awful." WVU President E. Gordon Gee said at the end of the meeting that nothing approved today bars our students from intellectual exploration or well-rounded liberal arts education. "As I have tried to say on many occasions, West Virginia University has been and always will be a university that offers a variety of majors." And, he said, "aligning majors with future careers is a necessity in today's world." Lisa M. De Bartolomeo, a teaching professor of Russian Studies and Slavic and East European Studies, said by phone Friday that she worried the university would be the canary in the coal mine for other universities in a corporatized model that looks at return on investment as opposed to the value of liberal arts education and what that means for society. She said she was sure some people were upset with students for being so disruptive. "But as a faculty member who was about to lose her job, I was pretty heartened by the support we got from the students," she said, fighting back tears. Although it's not certain yet which positions will be eliminated, she is worried for everyone in her department. Felicia Carrara, a sophomore from Maryland majoring in International Studies and Russian Studies, said she was thinking about transferring. "In a time of globalization, it doesn't really make sense to eliminate foreign language majors," she said. Ebbing enrollment has pushed the state's largest public university into a tight fiscal position. The flagship Morgantown campus had about 29,700 students in the fall of 2012, but the headcount fell 17% over the next decade in a nearly continuous slide to about 24,700 in the fall of 2022. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The next article comes from NPR, and it's titled, "Student loan borrowers are spending a lot of time on hold," says federal watchdog. Posted September 11, 2023, by Corey Turner. Millions of Americans are getting ready to repay their federal student loans next month, and many have questions, from where to get started online to what repayment plan is right for them. Early signs suggest that the companies the government pays to answer those questions are struggling, as borrowers flood their phone lines. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB, and its director, Rohit Chopra, are watching loan servicers closely, collecting data on how much time borrowers spend on hold and how many simply give up before they even get through. "What you're hearing is what we're seeing as well," Chopra told me in a recent interview. "And what I'm hearing," I told Chopra, "is frustration from borrowers like Steve Kalka in Houston, who wants to know, why does it take so long for my loan servicer to respond or to approve my documents or to really get any answers back to me in a timely manner?" Chopra says not only are borrowers having to wait for answers, we're seeing that many borrowers are struggling to even get through to their servicers. The problems are plenty. For one, the system is more complex than ever, with the Education Department and servicers rolling out a new repayment plan at the same time the department is doing an unprecedented review of borrowers' records and adjusting millions of accounts. Making matters worse, several of the largest servicers ended their contracts during the pandemic, forcing a tidal wave of borrowers and their records onto other servicers. Finally, there's the sheer overwhelming math of it all. In normal times, the handful of companies that service federal student loans have to help a few million borrowers a year move into repayment. But right now, they need to help 39 to 40 million and do it with less money than usual. That's because Congress essentially froze the Education Department's funding for 2023. Instead of ramping up, the department is telling its servicers, scale back. The department indicated that because of budget cuts, there's going to be a need to reduce weekend and evening call center hours, says Scott Buchanan, who heads the Student Loan Servicing Alliance, a trade group for loan servicers. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. The final article comes from BBC News, and it's titled, UK's First School Set Up in Partnership with Orchestra Opens. Posted by Katie Rozzle. The UK's first new school to be partnered with a professional orchestra has opened its doors to pupils. Shireland CBSO Academy and the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra offer pupils weekly workshops, performances, and masterclasses, and free instrumental tuition for at least 2 years. Orchestra head Emma Senning told the BBC, "There is a crisis in music education in schools." The Department for Education said it is, quote, committed to education in music. "We remain committed to ensuring that every young person has access to a high-quality music education," it told the BBC. The brand new state school is in a former office block in Sandwell, one of England's most deprived boroughs. It opened with 138 Year 7s on the 5th of September, with more joining in the next few weeks. The BBC is the first media to be invited in since the Academy started its new term. A state-of-the-art performance hall is being built, with ridged acoustic paneling and angled walls to ensure the best sound quality. Music is also embedded into the Academy curriculum. Pupils studying the great fictional detective Sherlock Holmes, for example, learn how an understanding of music and rhythm can help them decipher the Morse code. Principal David Green said the school follows the national curriculum. "We are a completely normal school," he said. "We have French, art, maths, science, all the things you'd expect, but we have this really special partnership with the CBSO, which is giving these students a level of musical opportunity they just wouldn't get elsewhere." His intention is for every student to study GCSE music, a subject which has seen a dramatic fall in take-up in recent years. And we'll have to cut that article short for time. We've run out of time for this episode of Education Today. Please be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kenny Park Yee for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Education Today is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.